as one of the mantras of the Upanishad was sung in the beginning, where that Upanishad says that the whole is whole. Even if you take away everything from it, even then it remains whole. Mathematically impossible. Because as I said, the whole is not identical with the total. If you take away everything, then that totality is gone. But even if you take away everything, the whole remains whole. There is no diminution so far as that state of wholeness is concerned. This is the holistic approach that the Upanishads have given throughout the ages, and to which, as I said, modern science, particularly modern physics, is leading us to. There is one factor, and that factor is action. After all, as practical people, we are concerned with action. We are not concerned with philosophical subtleties. We want to act, because action is something that is imperative. I cannot exist without action. From moment to moment, I must act. And in order that I may act, I must choose. Because without choice, there is no action whatsoever. Life is so complex, it is so complicated. There are so many things that are intermixed that I must be able to make the right choice. If I want to act, then choice is imperative. But how do we choose? We do act. But by and large, our action is not conducive to happiness. We find that we act, but later on we have to repent for what we have done. In other words, the action that has emanated from choice probably has not been right. Giordano Bruno, who was a brilliant philosopher in Italy, one of the most brilliant of the philosophers that history has seen, and he had to suffer for his philosophical statements. But Giordano Bruno says at one place in one of his lectures, and he says something which is so obvious, and we think that we did not need Giordano Bruno to tell us that. What is it that Giordano Bruno says? He says, if the first button of your coat is wrongly buttoned, all the rest are crooked. A very simple statement. Because we may strive as much as we like to straighten the rest of the buttons, we can't. Because the first button is wrongly buttoned. Now, what is this first button? This first button is right perception. If I do not have right perception, I cannot know what right action is. Perception is the starting point. And this perception is vitiated. Modern physics has started talking about it. Modern physics, for example, says that in every act of observation, the observer is involved. In every act of perception, the perceiver is involved. And if the perceiver is involved, then I cannot see what is, because the perceiver modifies, the observer modifies. This is what physics has seen at the level of matter, because they say we are unable to see what is. In fact, if you look at this, that very fascinating book, Physics as Metaphor by Robert Jones, there he says that we scientists are still like the cavemen of Plato. You know, Plato has given this simile of the cave. And Plato says there are some people who are so conditioned they can't turn round. Their faces are in front of the wall. There is light coming from behind. And there are shadows that are cast on the wall. And these people are all the time seeing the shadows. They do not know what is outside, but only the shadows are seen, and from the shadows they speculate about what must be happening. For them, shadows are the realities. And this scientist who speaks about physics as metaphor says that we have not moved away. We scientists are still in the cave, and we are still looking at the wall. We are still looking at the shadows, although the shadows have changed. But still they are the shadows. We do not know what is beside the shadows. We are only talking about shadows and nothing but the shadows. And if you have turned to that book, very enlightening book, The Quantum Questions, Then in the introduction of that book, The Quantum Questions, the editor of that book says that qualitatively nothing has happened. We are still at that same level where the 19th century science was. We are still dealing with shadows. But he says, one great thing has happened. That in the 19th century science, we thought that shadows were the realities. Today, in the 20th century, although we see shadows, we realize that these are shadows and these are not realities. This is all that has happened so far as the vast revolution in the scientific field has taken place. In other words, they say that it is the observer that is projecting himself into every act of observation. And with this, obviously, the object of perception is modified. Then how are we to come to the right perception? Because if we do not have right perception, it is impossible for us to act rightly. And right action is the imperative need of man, even today, in this complex world of science and technology. Right action is our imperative need. But right action demands right perception. And right perception is not possible so long as the perceiver comes in between, modifying the object of perception. And therefore, the question of questions is, how to get rid of this perceiver? How to get rid of the observer? Because the right perception can be only where there is neither the perceiver nor the perceived. So long as the perceiver is there, then the perceived will come into existence. Because the perceived is only his scale of observation. From his scale of observation, he has created the observed. We all of us live in an observed world. We do not know what the real world is. It is only the observed world, the world as observed from our scale of observation. As one Swiss scientist says beautifully, that it is the scale of observation which creates the phenomenon. From my scale of observation, this is the phenomenon. This was the idea that was spoken about by the Hindu philosophers when they gave the example of the rope and the snake. What is in front of me is rope, but I see it as a snake. And I tell everybody, don't go near it because there is a snake. I'm also not going to go there because the snake may bite me. But the fact of the matter is that there is a rope. From where has the non-existent snake come? Because the snake is non-existent. From where has it come? This is an example which is given in Hindu philosophy again and again. From where has the non-existent snake come? It is a projection of the human mind. It is the mind that has projected, out of its conditioning factors. The mind has projected. And you must have heard the verse of the Upanishad, the very first verse of one of the greatest of the Upanishads, the Ishavasya Upanishad, where the teacher of the Upanishad says, that truth is just in front of you. God, truth, reality, whatever you want to call. It is just in front of you. You don't have to go anywhere at all. It is just in front of you. But you are not able to see because a screen has been cast. Between you and that which you want to see, there is a screen. And the screen is beautiful. And therefore, if somebody says, remove the screen and you will see the truth, then I say, remove the screen. Screen is so beautiful. How can there be anything more beautiful than the screen? And therefore we do not remove the screen. What is the screen? The screen is the projection of the human mind. In one of the books of Shankaracharya, a great philosopher, a great mystic philosopher of India, in one of his books known as The Crest Jewel of Discrimination, which has been translated in English, there this great mystic philosopher says that the human mind has twofold activities. One activity of the human mind is the activity of distractions. We know it. I don't think it is necessary for me to labor that point, that the mind is all the time distracted. There is a distracting tendency. Distraction is one of the activities of the human mind. But he says there is another activity of the human mind, and that is the projecting activity. And he says, don't bother about distractions. Distractions will go automatically. But take care of the projecting activities of the mind. because you are distracted only by that which you have projected. And therefore, if the projection goes away, then the problem of distraction is not there. Meditation becomes simple. Because in meditation, we have the great difficulty of distractions. And we go on fighting and fighting and fighting. Because we think that meditation is the question of thoughts. I must remove the thought, I must remove the thought, I must remove that undesirable thought. Thought is not the problem in meditation. It is thinker that is the problem in meditation. It is the thinker that is the problem. It is the perceiver that is the problem. It is the observer that is the problem. It is the experiencer that is the problem. And therefore, unless and until we deal with this question, we cannot have right perception, and therefore we cannot talk in terms of right action. This is the vast field in which these Upanishads have operated. 11 major Upanishads. They have operated in this vast field, the field of the perceiver and the perceived. How can one get rid of the perceiver? Because even if you change your scale of observation, perhaps you may not see the snake, you will see something else. You may see a tiger, you may see a lion. Because if, after all, the scale of observation that creates the phenomenon, then a mere change of the scale of observation will not solve the problem. The problem of problems is, can there be a perception without any scale of observation, with no scale of observation whatsoever? This seems meaningless so far as the mind is concerned. We say, we must have a scale of observation. But no, the Upanishads say, and this is the revolutionary statement of the Upanishads, that the right perception is possible only when there is no scale of perception whatsoever. It may last, even though it may last for a split second, but it is in that split second that the right perception is possible. Sri Aurobindo once again says, the moment sees, it is the ages that toil to express. The moment sees, the perception is only in moment. But not moment in terms of our watches or of our clocks. We are talking of moment in terms of the mind. Because after all, what is time? Time doesn't have its own existence. Time doesn't exist by itself. Time is the creator of the human mind. In fact, the flow of thought is identical with the flow of time. Time and the flow of thought are identical. And therefore, if I can stop the flow of thought, then I have stopped the flow of time for the time being. In other words, I have come to that timeless moment. And the Upanishads have spoken about the timeless moment. It is the approach of the perception which comes in the timeless moment, not in the duration of time. We have to exist in time. But if we can bring in the existence of time the vision of the timeless, if we can bring the ecstasy of the timeless in the field of time, then our journey in time will not be frustrating at all. Then our becoming will be full of joy, full of delight, because then that becoming is not the process of the mind, but it is the process of that vision, the vision that has come in the timeless moment. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with that parable, that story that you find in Zen Buddhism. In Zen Buddhism, there is said, a disciple went to the master and said, "Master, I want to become Buddha. Please tell me how to become Buddha." And the master did not give immediately reply. Second time the pupil asked, third time the pupil asked, "Master, tell me how to become Buddha." When the third time the pupil put that question, then the master took hold of a piece of brick that was lying and started rubbing that piece of brick on the floor. And the pupil said, "Master, what are you doing? I have placed before you a serious question and you are indulging in this ridiculous activity of rubbing this brick on the floor. What is the idea?" Then the master said, "I am rubbing this brick on the floor because I want to make it into a mirror." And the disciple said, "Nonsense, this can never happen, this is absurd. The brick will wear out, but the brick will not become a mirror." Then the master said, "My son, you have answered your own question. You cannot become Buddha if you are not Buddha already. You can become only what you are. You cannot become what you are not. This is the basis of the philosophy of the Upanishads, that you can become only what you are. You cannot become what you are not, and therefore find out what you are. Not the mental image of ourselves, but find out what we are by removing all the images that we have built of ourselves. Find out what you are. If you find out what you are, then the problem of becoming is no problem at all. Becoming will be spontaneous and natural out of the perception of the being. And therefore the right perception demands the removal of the perceiver. But who is the perceiver? The perceiver is the human mind. And therefore when this human mind becomes silent for the time being, then in the silence of that mind, don't ask me how to come to that silence, we will go into that question, partly this afternoon, then later on when we discuss the question of meditation. But this perceiver must go. In other words, this mind becomes silent. Then in that silence of the mind, there is to be found that which is. I shall know in that silence of the mind what I am. Then I don't have to ask the question, how can I become that? That being itself becomes the becoming. The being is the motivating factor. It becomes naturally and spontaneously. The becoming, the natural becoming, the spontaneous becoming, this is the basis of the Upanishads. I do not want to prolong because we will have questions. And then in the afternoon, we will go into the question, how can one tread this path, this way of the Upanishads? Is it possible for us to tread? But before I come to that, I just want to draw our attention to one story that is found once again in one of the major Upanishads. The story is, in the Puranas, in the mythologies, you will find all the time there is a conflict going on between the good and the evil. The good and the evil, the forces of good and the forces of evil. All the time the conflict goes on. The forces of good are represented in Hindu mythology as the Devas, as the angels, as the illuminated entities. And the forces of darkness, the forces of evil are represented by the demons. And they all the time fight. Not that the Puranas are only concerned with this outer fight. It is the fight that is going on within us, between the good and the evil, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness, the fight that is going on. And once the forces of light had a victory over the forces of darkness. And those who represented the forces of light were greatly elated. They say, see, by our own strength we have been able to defeat these forces of darkness. We have such power, we have such greatness, that the forces of evil can be vanquished by our strength. While they were discussing this in the assembly of the Devas, in the assembly of the angels, in the assembly of those who represented the spirit of goodness, they found that there was some individual, exquisitely beautiful individual who was seated somewhere there. And these Devas, who were rejoicing, they said, "Who is this? We have never seen such a beautiful person ever. Who is this?" And therefore they said, "We must find out who this entity is." And they said that you, who are the lords of Agni, lords of fire, please go and find out who that person is. And the lords of the fire went. And that beautiful person who was seated there said, "Who are you?" The lords of the fire said, "Don't you know what we are? We are the lords of fire." He said, "All right, what can you do?" He said, "Oh, we can burn anything to ashes immediately. That is our power." Then this person, the beautiful person, said, "Here is a dry blade of grass. Please burn it." And the Devas, the lords of fire, they tried as much as they could. They could not burn that dry blade of grass. Reported to the assembly of the gods, "We do not know who this person is. We only know that we are crestfallen. We have been defeated. We have not been able to burn this dry blade of grass." "All right, then what shall we do?" Then the assembly of the gods said, "Please, you, the god of the air, God of the winds, you go and find out who this person is. And the God of the air, the God of the winds went. Once again, the same dialogue. Who are you? They said, we are gods of fire, gods of air, gods of wind. What can you do? They said, we can lift anything that is on the ground and put it to the other end of the earth. This person said, all right, here is a blade of grass, please do it. And the gods tried and tried and tried, they could not even lift that blade of grass. Leave apart, sending it to the other part of the world. They returned. They said, we don't know who this entity is. We know that we are completely crestfallen. Our strength, our power was of no use whatsoever when we were confronted with this question. Then what are we to do? Then the assembly of the gods said to Indra. Indra is one of the chief of the devas, the chief of the gods in Hindu. Who is Indra? Indra is mind. Indra is the Raja of the senses, as Madame Blavatsky speaks about in The Voice of the Silence. Indra is the Raja of the senses, the mind. He said, please, you go and find out. And Indra goes. And when Indra went there, Indra found that there was nobody there to whom he could ask the question. That person himself had disappeared. This is a very significant statement. When the mind wants to understand what reality is, there is no reality at all. Because the mind cannot question that reality. That reality disappears, the mind is not able to see that reality. And so Indra, poor thing, he just stood there. And there was nothing but void. Into that void came a figure that is known as the feminine figure, the goddess, Uma. Uma came. Uma, the meaning of Uma is night. And she came out of the night, out of the darkness of the void. She came and told Indra that, look here, the victory about which you talk, which you are celebrating, is not because of you. But it is because of this person. This person is the Brahman, it is the ultimate reality. It is he who has enabled you to be victorious in that particular battle. By yourselves you are nobodies whatsoever. This is the message that you find in the Upanishads. In other words, there is that entity, the supreme entity, which you cannot hold. It is intangible, something that cannot be possessed. Something that is unmanifest about which I was speaking, but that which can operate on manifestation. And how and when we shall see when we come to the second part. But here we find that there is a link between the manifest and the unmanifest, between the transcendental and the immanent. That link is broken with the operation of the mind. But when the mind becomes silent, then suddenly that link comes into existence. And therefore, that which was devoid of life suddenly becomes full of life and vitality. Why? Because of the touch of that transcendental. The Upanishads speak about the touch of the transcendental. Because they say it is that and that alone that can put life and vitality into all that is manifested. The manifest and the unmanifest are two different things but completely related. And because they are related, we are able to understand the meaning of the explicate order. Because of the functioning of the implicate order, there is a link. But how are we going to find out that link? Can we discover it? Can we discover in our day-to-day life that link between the unmanifest and the manifest? Then we will find that our life in manifestation is full of delight and happiness. We are not frustrated individuals. We do not talk of tensions and stresses and strains. We will not be ill individuals. We will be healthy, because health itself means wholeness. But this wholeness is not the assembly of the parts. The wholeness comes in the presence of that spiritual magnet. That spiritual magnet is the touch of the transcendental, the touch of the unmanifest. How is one to come to this touch of the unmanifest? In the day-to-day life, in the great difficulties with which we are confronted from time to time, how can we discover the spiritual magnet? The very presence of the spiritual magnet brings about a beautiful pattern of life. The iron filings have not to be put in a pattern. They come naturally and spontaneously into a pattern because of the presence of the spiritual magnet. The Upanishads are concerned with the discovery of the spiritual magnet. How shall we be able to do it? Because this is a practical aspect. Can we in our day-to-day living discover the spiritual magnet? We can. That is what the Upanishads say. But how? We shall go into that question when we meet in the afternoon. Here in this session we have only talked about what is this way of the Upanishads. The way of wholeness, the way of polarities, the way of the transcendence and the immanence, the way of the manifest and the unmanifest meeting together. What is this way? We shall go into the question, how is one to tread this way? Because this is the practical implication so far as the vast and profound philosophy of the Upanishads is concerned. Thank you. Now this is the question time, so, yes?
Could you explain some of the Upanishads that directly relate to the sutras, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali?
The question is, can I relate some of the Upanishads with the Yoga Sutras, say, of Patanjali? The fact of the matter is that the Upanishads came much earlier than the Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Patanjali came much later. In fact, some of the historians say that probably Patanjali was contemporary of Buddha. But the Upanishads appeared much before that. In fact, the Upanishads are a part of the Vedas. You know, there are four Vedas. Vedas are the earliest of the literature that you can find in human civilization. There are four Vedas, the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, and the Atharva Veda. Now, every Veda has four aspects. First aspect of the Veda is the mantra, the recitation of certain sacred statements. These are the mantras. The second is the Brahmanas, where are put certain rituals and certain ceremonies, certain patterns of social behavior. That is the second part of the Vedas. The third part of the Vedas is what are known as the Aranyakas. They deal with the intellectual dissertations, the intellectual discussions, intellectual speculations on deep questions of life. And the fourth part of every Veda is Upanishad. And therefore Upanishads are a part of the Vedas. That is why the philosophy of the Upanishad is known as the Vedanta. Vedanta means that which comes at the end of the Vedas. It is the final portion of the Vedas, that is why it is known as Vedanta. And therefore the Upanishads, they form the last, the spiritual part, not merely intellectual, but that part which deals with the problems of spiritual realization, that is the Upanishad. And since these Upanishads are a part of the Vedas, they were much, much earlier than the Patanjali Yoga Sutras. And that is why it is not possible to relate them, although there are statements concerning yoga about which I spoke in the beginning. For example, in the Kathopanishad or other Upanishads, you find mention about yoga, but that is much prior to what Patanjali has given. But first of all, we must understand that Patanjali has not given a new system of yoga at all. Patanjali only synthesized all those yoga statements that existed during his time. And therefore, he has also taken certain statements from the Upanishads. But he was a compiler. He has synthesized all the yoga approaches that were during his time. And therefore, it is not possible to find out a relationship between Patanjali and the Upanishads, because historically speaking, Upanishads were much, much earlier than the arrival of the Yoga Sutras. Yes?
I would like to have a discourse on one of the paradoxes that you brought up, that light, duality, wave, and particle. And the thing I'm questioning is, we never see the wave-particle duality simultaneously in experiments. You see one in one experiment and one in another experiment. Yeah. Why do we have to say then that light has both simultaneously?
That is what the scientific writers tell us. That is why I'm saying I'm not a scientist. But I've told you what I've read in the scientific books. Although this aspect of duality is very much emphasized in Hindu philosophy. For example, in Hindu philosophy, there is the paradox of Shiva and Shakti. Or what you find in Chinese philosophy as yang and yin. Although there is a difference between the Chinese concept of yang and yin and the Hindu concept of Shiva and Shakti. Shiva and Shakti, according to Hindu philosophy, are not two different things. Shiva is Shakti and Shakti is Shiva. When Shiva wants to manifest, then he becomes Shakti. When Shakti withdraws, then she becomes Shiva. In other words, they are the phenomenon of the same manifestation. You may call Shiva as the particle. You may call Shakti as the wave, because there is a mobility. There is the stillness and the mobility. And the stillness and mobility together, that is what the Hindu philosophy has expressed. And you will find in some of the writings, not merely Kapra, but many of the writings, you will find, for example, there is a scientific book called Mysticism and the New Physics. If you turn to the Mysticism of New Physics, or you turn to any of these writers, you will find that they seem to be concerned about this question, that they have not to make a choice between particle and wave, because there is no possibility of a choice. Mysteriously, that which was particle suddenly becomes a wave. That which is wave suddenly becomes particle. And therefore this mysterious behavior, it is not able to understand, because there is no possibility of choosing between this and that, which was the case so far as the Cartesian approach to life was concerned. Either this or that. But they seem to be thinking there is no either this or that. There seems to be a third way. Third way, in which the two opposites seem to be functioning together as complementaries. And the Upanishads have spoken about that third way. That third way was spoken about by Buddha, when Buddha talked of the middle way. The middle way of the Buddha was not a compromise between this and that. That something of this and something of that. Something of particle and something of wave. Something of stillness and something of mobility. That was not the middle path of Buddha. The middle path of Buddha, if we want to understand, we must go to mathematics. In mathematics, there is a definition of a line. And we know what is a line. A line has length but no breadth. Or a point. A point has position but no magnitude. You can't put that point at all. Any paper you put the point, then you have put not only the position but magnitude. The moment you have drawn a line, that line has not merely length but it has breadth. And therefore the line of geometry and the point of geometry, this is something which you can't manifest. And yet the entire mathematics depends upon that, which seems to be intangible. The point of mathematics is intangible. The line of mathematics is intangible. And yet the whole structure of mathematics rests upon this. This is exactly what the Upanishads say. The Upanishads say that the spiritual path is a razor-edged path. Razor-edged, because you may fall here, you may fall there. It is a path which is not a compromise, but it is a path like the line. If you can walk on that line, but to walk on that line is something like what Madame Blavatsky says in The Voice of the Silence. Hold fast to that which has neither substance nor existence. How can you do it? How can you walk on a line? And yet this is exactly the middle path. This is exactly the path about which the Upanishads speak. That it is something intangible. The mind cannot define it. The mind cannot describe it. But it is something which can be experienced in the totality of mind's silence. Yeah.
Say that it's the tendency of the rational mind to see things as opposites in order to understand them, but I haven't heard you mention the concept of Maya. Do they have to do with anything similar?
Maya. Yes, this word Maya is very much misunderstood.
Yes.
Maya is not illusion in the ordinary sense of the term that we use. Oh, it's all illusion. The Hindu philosophers never said this world is an illusion, it doesn't exist. Never said that. But what Maya is, There is the explanation of this Maya that you find in one of the verses of the Bhagavad Gita. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says to Arjuna, his disciple, that Lord resides in the heart of everybody, whether sinner or saint, in the heart of everybody. And yet he says people don't find that reality. They go here, there, everywhere, go to jungles and caves and go to guru after guru in order to find out that reality. But he says reality is there. It resides in the heart of everyone. But why is it that people are not able to find? It is there that the Gita uses the word Maya. And the word Maya, as I said, is very important in the Sanskrit language. The word Maya comes from the root Ma. And Ma in the Sanskrit language means to measure. He says you cannot find because you go with a measuring tape. You want to measure everything. You want to measure reality. You want to measure God. You want to measure happiness. You want to measure love. And therefore you can't find it. Because there are certain things which are immeasurable. You cannot find through measurement. Now, this is the idea of Maya that is given to us. When one tries to measure something that is immeasurable, then one is caught in Maya. And therefore, so long as I regard something as relative, oh, this is relative. This is what appears from my scale of observation. But the moment I regard the relative as the absolute, then I am caught in Maya. I am caught in illusion. I am caught in something which has no meaning whatsoever. So long as I say, yes, this is relative. Perhaps from your scale of observation, it may appear different. But this is what appears from my standpoint. So long as I regard my perception as relative and not regard it as absolute, I am free from this process of illusion. But the moment the relative is identified with the absolute, then there comes this whole question of Maya or illusion.
Do you have any other thoughts about any Upanishads that deal directly with the ideas of mantra and sound?
Oh, there are, of course. But mantra yoga is a yoga by itself. Leave apart the Upanishads. But the mantra yoga is a yoga by itself. There are references to mantra. There are references to mantra in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra also. There is the whole science of mantras. But I have not turned to that because it is a subject by itself. In fact, the science of mantra is very much studied in that aspect of literature about what I spoke in the earlier part, the tantra. There are the vast tantras. There are tantras of all types. The tantra is a technique. And it is in that tantra that you find the exhaustive reflections and discussions of mantra, efficacy of mantra. How mantra must be articulated, how it must be spoken. There is only one reference in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra to mantra, where Patanjali says that the repetition, because mantra implies repetition, that all this repetition of mantra has a validity only, first of all, if it is uttered rightly, there is a right sound effect of it, and every mantra demands the proper articulation so that there is a particular sound effect. It must have that. Secondly, there must be the understanding of the meaning. There must be the thought form. Not merely the sound form, but also the correct thought form in the repetition of the mantra. But that alone is not enough. The sound form, thought form, but there must be the feeling that you must feel what you are going to talk about, what you are going to repeat. There must be the feeling, that is what Patanjali calls the bhavana. There must be the experience. I utter the name of God, but if it is just an utterance, articulation, if it is only an intellectual meaning, but nothing deeper than the intellectual meaning, then that particular recitation of mantra will have no effect whatsoever. In any case, there is a science of mantra, and mantra has been studied from a scientific standpoint in the old literature of the Hindus.
You spoke about the basic philosophy of Descartes, and you can talk about social philosophy also from the Western tradition as being a perseverer of dualism, especially coming down to the 20th century. Do you feel that that is something that is unique to the Western culture as opposed to all of man?
It is as much a part of it, because in the East also we have known of this dialectical functioning of the mind. In fact, there is the whole scripture which deals with logic. And in that logic, this dialectical aspect of the mind is discussed. So it is not something which is Western or something that is Eastern. But it is true that in the West it has been emphasized, in the East it has not been so emphasized.
I have a question about, you mentioned the Absolute, and it is the Absolute changeable?
If the Absolute is changeable, it is not Absolute at all, isn't it? But Absolute appears to the mind as coming in succession. It is the appearance of the mind, seeing something in succession. And therefore he says, oh, it's all the time changing. But if truth changes, it is no truth at all. But it appears to change because our perception is focused at that particular level, successive consciousness. And the successive consciousness tells me, oh, truth was this, now this is truth, now this is truth. But what I have noticed is only the behavior of truth. The behavior of truth is bound to change, not the being of truth. But the moment I identify the behavior with the being, then the difficulty arises. Behavior is only an expression. As Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, with only one aspect of myself I stand in this world. I am intrinsically unmanifest, he says. But I come into manifestation with one aspect. The moment I begin to worship that one aspect, then the relative becomes absolute for me. And therefore I want to hold it. Oh, it must not change, it must not change, it must not change at all. I want to hold it. And from there the frustration arises. The one expression of truth is not truth. But we want to believe that one expression is the truth. And therefore I am not prepared to examine other manifestations of that truth. But if I hold it lightly, yes, this is what I have understood. But there may be other expressions also. If I hold it very lightly, then there is no difficulty. But when I become dogmatic, this is and nothing else, then the difficulty arises.